Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Robert M. Ellis, the chair of the Middle Way Society, and he's here to talk to us today about his forthcoming book, The Buddha's Middle Way. Welcome back, Robert, to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thank you, Barry.
Okay, well, perhaps you could begin, Robert, by telling us what prompted you to write the book.
Okay, well, The Buddha's Middle Way has arisen out of coming back to Buddhism, I suppose, after an interval. So I have in the past been a practicing Buddhist, and I've also written about Buddhism to some extent. But in recent years, I've been very much concerned with exploring the Middle Way and Middle Way philosophy in its own terms as a universal thing, which isn't subject to a particular tradition. But I was moved to come back to Buddhism, particularly by, I suppose, increasing awareness that people do predominantly approach things through traditions, and also that Buddhism is a great source of inspiration for people. So there's a whole set of emotional connections and sort of life, human connections that people have with the Buddha, which makes it the way in which people can understand the Middle Way, or the easiest way that they have of approaching the Middle Way. So I wanted to make connections between Middle Way philosophy as I developed it, kind of independent of Buddhism, and Buddhism, and show that Buddhism could be, particularly the Buddha himself, could be presented and understood in a way which is, you know, entirely compatible with Middle Way philosophy.
Okay, great. Just before we start discussing the book in more detail, I thought I might mention that you're actually running a retreat in the autumn based on the content of the book. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it will be a weekend retreat in Worcestershire in the UK. So similar format to a lot of the retreats we've run in the Middle Way Society in the past. So we have a mixture of activities, some meditation, some talks and discussion, some arts kind of activity. But obviously the focus will be the way that the Buddha can provide a way into the Middle Way. So it will be related to the book in that sense.
Okay, well, why should we be interested in the Buddha then?
Well, obviously in some ways it's just a matter of acknowledging the source, you know, acknowledging the chief source for the Middle Way that we have, because, you know, the Buddha is associated overwhelmingly with the Middle Way. When you say the word Middle Way, the Buddha tends to come up. But yeah, I think there are some strong sources of inspiration for the Middle Way in the life and the teachings of the Buddha. So particularly the early life of the Buddha, before his enlightenment, that period. And in the teachings of the Buddha, obviously he talked about the Middle Way, but I find particularly in the Buddha's metaphors, so there's a whole section of the book devoted to exploring ways in which some of the Buddha's key metaphors are universal in nature. So they're not just ways of sort of illustrating Buddhist teachings in a dry or culturally specific fashion. They're actually metaphors that can, well, illuminate everybody's judgment, so they're relevant to everybody in every situation.
Could you perhaps give us an example?
Okay. Well, I talk in the book about, for example, the raft and the lute strings and the arrow. Those are all very important metaphors used by the Buddha. I mean, the lute strings is maybe a good one to start with, because the Middle Way nature of the lute strings is very clear. So there the Buddha was talking to one of his disciples who was struggling with his meditation, a guy called Sona, according to the Pali Canon scriptures. And he was struggling with his meditation, but the Buddha then asked him about his previous experience as a musician. And this guy, Sona, had previously played the lute. And so the Buddha asked him about, you know, if he tuned the lute, what happened if the strings were too taut or if they were too slack. And obviously Sona said or recognized that you don't get a good note, you don't get a good tune out of your lute if it's not tuned properly. And so the comparison there is obviously to see the state of the whole body and mind, not just in meditation, I think, but it has implications for beyond meditation as well. But generally, when we make judgments in the whole of our experience, if we're too rigidly keyed up physically, that can also be related to absolute beliefs about what it is we're keyed up about. that's one kind of extreme to avoid. But the other, physically, is being too relaxed, which can also be associated with an absolute belief that there's nothing to get worked up about here, you know, that there's no need to make an effort. So the idea of balanced effort, as it feeds into the idea of the middle way, is very much illustrated by that little metaphor that he used.
Yeah, great example there. Okay, so how do you deal with the issues of interpretation of the Buddha?
Well, this is one of the issues that's going to confront anybody who tries to write about the Buddha. I think that we're talking about somebody who lived roughly 2,500 years ago in India, or in the Indian subcontinent, and anything that you might say about it based on scholarly information could be contradicted or could be questioned because there's so much uncertainty about it. And as a result, there is a lot of scholarly stuff around the Buddha. And what I've been trying to do in this book is just gently push that aside, really. Not to say that it's worthless at all. It is helpful in various ways, but it's not the key thing for gaining an understanding of what we can practically get from the stories and teachings of the Buddha. So it doesn't have to be justified by some sort of historical revelation or belief about the Buddha's enlightenment or anything of that kind in order to be valuable to us. What the criterion that I'm trying to put across in the book is very much that the middle way is justified experientially by whether it works. And if that's the case, we don't have to hold on to very strong absolute beliefs about what happened historically to the Buddha.
Okay. Could you go perhaps into a bit more detail about the relationship between the Buddha and the middle way? I know you've touched on it, but if you could just explore that a little bit more.
Mm. Well, I think it's illustrated very strongly in his life, for one thing. So the story of him, and it is a story, I'm not saying it's anything more than a story, but a story of him leaving the palace in his youth, so that he was in a very sheltered position to start with. And then he went forth, as the expression has it, into the forest. And there he sought the religious life as it existed, the ascetic or religious life of the time, the status of a shramana, as it was known, a sort of homeless religious wanderer. So he went from one extreme to the other, you could say. He went from a very sheltered, civilized situation where he could have everything he wanted into one of total insecurity in order to try and pursue a kind of unworldly religious goal. And then he realized that wasn't going to work out as he hoped either, in the sense that there were people instructing him there, teachers, religious teachers, from whom he could learn a lot, but that he wouldn't get everything from that, and that he wouldn't get this kind of fixed result of enlightenment from doing the practices that he was being instructed in, or indeed the asceticism, which he then moved on to, the inflicting hardship on yourself in the hope that this will lead to merit. So the middle way comes organically then out of this trying one extreme and then the other. And he discovers the middle way, which depends much more on him, on his body, and reaching a state in his body where he could make better judgments, you know, having looked after his body as a basic starting point, rather than starving it, for instance.
Do you think we all, to some extent, inevitably have to go through a similar process, what the Buddha did, to explore one extreme and then the other, to find that sort of balance?
I think that's very likely to be a process that we go through, yes. So supposing you're brought up in some very strongly ideological environment, whether it's, you know, say religious or political, once you gain a critical perspective on the assumptions made in that environment, you're likely to go through a phase where you're going to the opposite extremes in some way. So somebody who's had a very strong religious upbringing, for example, in Christianity, say, or Islam, may well have an atheist phase before they can find some sort of balance in their view of the religious background they've come from. But I suppose the key thing there is to recognise that it is, you know, it's perhaps a necessary process for people, but it's not an end in itself to stop in that reactive phase. Yeah. So the Buddha's a very good illustration of that.
Yeah, no, I can certainly see that in my own life. I've been through several processes like that. Okay, why should the middle way be given priority amongst the Buddha's teachings?
Basically, I think because it's, as I understand it, and as I think we can justify from the Buddha's life and teachings too, it's about judgment. So before you interpret any other teaching, then you need to be able to work out how to judge it. So to take an example of another well-known Buddhist teaching, say if you take what's known as dukkha, which is often translated as suffering or sometimes unsatisfactoriness or frustration. So very often that's presented as the state of the world or the state of our phenomenal relationship with the world, that it's going to be a world of suffering. But if you just take that as a sort of complete description, then I think you'll have missed what practically the Buddhist tradition can offer you, because the point of that teaching, practically speaking, how it can be helpful to us is as a stimulus to recognize, well, there are certain things that are unsatisfactory and we can then work to improve them. So if you apply the middle way to that teaching, to the interpretation of that teaching, it's not giving you some kind of final truth about the state of things. It's there for a practical reason. And in interpreting it, you have to avoid absolute extremes of interpretation, whether they're positive or negative. So to talk about suffering or unsatisfactoriness in that way isn't just telling you, oh, everything's terrible, so therefore we've got to give up. Or indeed, you know, the opposite extreme, that there's nothing unsatisfactory that we need to work on. Yeah, you've got to be in some sort of middle position in order to be able to judge any of these other teachings in an appropriate and helpful way. The middle way, thus, in my view, comes first, you know, in interpreting the Four Noble Truths, so-called, or Four Tasks, as Stephen Batchelor calls them, or anything to do with the Buddha's status or enlightenment or any of the ethical teachings, or stuff about meditation or the Noble Eightfold Path, any of that. I think in order to make sense of it in a way that's practically helpful to us, we have to start with the middle way. So it's probably not a coincidence that the Buddha did that in his first sermon. You know, the middle way is the first thing he talks about.
Yeah. Is there a danger also that the middle way can also itself be put on a pedestal, that it's some kind of universal truth of the universe? How should we guard against that?
As far as I can see, the best way of guarding against that, and it is a real danger, yes, is just to keep in mind all the time it's a matter of judgment. So that we're making the judgment and we're having to take responsibility for that judgment. So, you know, as soon as we start turning it into a truth of some kind, it becomes more metaphysics, it becomes grist to the mill of the metaphysical factory, if you like. So yeah, there is this kind of long-standing ideological tendency humans have to turn absolutely anything that's helpful and balanced into some kind of absolute metaphysical doctrine.
You just mentioned responsibility there, and it seems to be a bit of a buzzword at the moment. What would you say the relationship is between responsibility and the middle way?
I suppose that responsibilities comes from our experience of being, well, of feeling responsible, whereas the way people often talk about it is in absolute terms, as particularly where other people are concerned. You know, so this criminal, for example, is completely responsible for their crime, or on the other extreme, that they're not. So what I think of as the total responsibility fallacy on the one hand, or the zero responsibility fallacy on the other. So in between there, there's linking it to our experience, which is feeling responsible, and developing that sense of responsibility in relation to the things we come across, so that we stretch ourselves a little bit and feel a little bit more responsible than we were before. So that, I think, is an application of the middle way to the whole issue of responsibility.
Okay.
And you can also see the Buddha doing that, actually. So there's this episode after he's supposed to have gained enlightenment, where he's sitting wondering whether he should go out and teach anybody, and wondering how hard it is, or recognizing how difficult it would be to communicate things to other people. But, you know, and he does recognize it'd be really difficult, but at the same time, he has this kind of voice of conscience, who's represented by a figure called Brahma Sahampati, that helps him to recognize, well, actually, there are some people who aren't that deluded, you know, people with little dust in their eyes who could be helped by what you're doing. So he begins then to take responsibility for his impact on the world, as well as what he's experienced himself. You know, he's gradually stretching that sense of responsibility, I think, at that point.
Interesting. You mentioned there that the Buddha's supposed enlightenment. Obviously, enlightenment for many people who consider themselves Buddhists or interested in Buddhism associate that term with Buddhism and the Buddha. Could you perhaps unpack what your thoughts are on that relationship?
Okay. Well, I think the positive value of enlightenment and all those ideas and all the development of enlightenment in Buddhism is archetypal. You know, so it can be an ideal for us, which is meaningful to us and a source of inspiration to us. The trouble is, in the Buddhist tradition, it's often been turned into a source of belief and a source of revelation. So the idea that the Buddha gained enlightenment, that then gives him sort of total key to reality, and he can then tell us total truths because he's had this experience. So that seems to have a revelatory function, which is really no different from those who claim to have heard the voice of God, and you know, in its function, it's no different from revelation in the theistic sense. So if you claim to have access to the truth, and then you tell others the truth, that's the kind of top-down kind of Buddhism that I criticize in the book. But there is always a kind of bottom-up interpretation of these aspects of the tradition as well. It's all about what we do with it, nearly always, with the materials that the tradition gives us.
How can the Buddha's life then, you talked about obviously his early life, but perhaps his ministry, how could that be an inspiration for the middle way?
There's the way in which he taught people, I think, is one obvious one, and also the way in which he negotiated politically with the kings in the area and the some of his more unruly disciples, you know, all that kind of thing. So he had a tricky organizational position, I think, the Buddha, in that he had to get support from the political overlords of the time, who were at odds with each other as well. So, you know, there were conflicts between the local kings, and there was political change, you know, between kind of republican and monarchical systems going on as well. So it's quite complex. So he had to look after the interests of his community, but at the same time, he's trying to communicate also in a helpful way to the political rulers, and I think in a way that might help them to make better judgments, you know, for their responsibilities as political rulers. So there's some very inspiring stuff, I think, not just the Buddha's more kind of obviously refined experiences of meditation and his finer teachings about how we change our states of mind, but also, you know, at the social and political level, you know, how does he deal with people with their problems? And how does he help to resolve conflict and avoid bias in the way that he deals with people?
Now, many people would say, Robert, that the middle way or their understanding of the middle way is one between eternalism and nihilism. But you argue that there's a lot more to the middle way than just those two extremes.
Indeed, yes. So this is a question, I think, of there being certain expressions of the middle way in the Buddha's time, which were very relevant to that time. But it's been assumed that these are universal ways of understanding it. And that's probably, I think, the prime reason why the way that Buddhism tends to formulate the middle way can be quite often less than useful. So the eternalism and nihilism is primarily usually interpreted as being about the self, the existence of the self after death. So in the Buddha's time, eternalists were people who believed that the self existed eternally, and thus also believed in karma and rebirth, and also believed in the morality that went with that. So it's kind of traditional absolute morality. And then there were the people who denied that, who were very much a minority, but nevertheless present, who were prepared to say there's no karma and rebirth. So they were the nihilists or annihilationists. So they believed in the annihilation of the self. Okay, that all applied in the Buddha's time. So primarily the absolutists and their deniers in the Buddha's time were those kinds of people. But if you try and apply that pattern to all the absolutizing that goes on in today's world, it just isn't adequate as a pattern, I think. Even if you stretch it in the ways that Nagarjuna subsequently did to talk about existence and non-existence, it's still not quite good enough, because there are so many different ways in which we can absolutize. And a lot of the ideologies that have been set up tend to cut across eternalism and nihilism. So Marxism is a very good example of that. It's got some eternalist and some nihilist features, but it's got, you know, lots of absolute thinking which you can't easily fit into those categories.
Yeah.
So I think it's much easier and simpler, more straightforward, just to say that the middle way is the middle way between positive and negative absolutes, wherever you find them. Those can take all sorts of forms, and they can cluster together and support each other in all sorts of complex ways. But that's the basic pattern of what the middle way is. And then wherever we encounter it, we can try and identify what those absolutes are and navigate between them without having to, this Buddhist theory, and worry about whether they're eternalist or nihilist, which, you know, then it ends you with unnecessary complications.
You just mentioned Nagarjuna there. How do you relate to the great Buddhist teachers who have stressed the middle way like him?
Well, obviously they've made a substantial contribution to the development of Buddhist thought, but I find a kind of lack of specifics in Nagarjuna or other Buddhist thinkers, really, on the whole, about judgment. So there's quite a lot of critical philosophy. There's criticality about the absolutes in some ways, but it doesn't really tell you much about how it applies to our experience. And certainly things like provisionality and integration and incrementality, which I think are very important aspects of the middle way, just aren't developed clearly for me in, say, the writings of Nagarjuna. So that's why I think, you know, you can get a lot of illumination from more modern sources, which I've also discussed at the end of the Buddha's Middle Way. So from neuroscience, for example, from bias theory, and from embodied meaning theory. So various kinds of different ways in which we can begin to understand, you know, that whole set of conditions and how they fit together.
Okay. Would you still call yourself a Buddhist?
I don't tend to use the label Buddhist, because primarily I take it as meaning allegiance to a tradition, or allegiance to the Buddhist tradition. And people tend to interpret that as an unconditional allegiance. So I can say I'm inspired by the Buddhist tradition. I try and engage with the Buddhist tradition. I have Buddhist friends, and indeed a Buddhist wife. But doesn't quite make me a Buddhist in that sense. But it all depends how you define the term. And other people have said I'm more Buddhist than the Buddhists in some ways. So I'm trying to take one element of Buddhism that I think is really vital and develop it. But in terms of those who would take the tradition as being the key thing, then I'm not. And I'm also, in other ways, I'm also a Christian in the sense that I'm very inspired by aspects of Christian tradition. And I've written about the Christian middle way as well. So I like to maintain my traditional independence, if you like.
So just tell us perhaps a couple of practicalities about the book, how people can engage with it. We mentioned there's a retreat in the autumn.
Yeah, it's published by Equinox, which is an academic publisher. You can get it in both ebook form and also paperback and, I believe, hardback if you really want to shell out for the hardback. And it's quite a substantial book, but the first section is about the Buddha's life and then the Buddha's metaphors, and then it goes into the more critical stuff about, you know, for example, the limitations of the Buddhist account of the middle way. And it also then finishes with brief accounts of other approaches to the middle way.
Okay, great, Robert. Okay, well, I wish you every success with it, and thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, thank you very much, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.